Hi, I'm Anthony Graves, and I am an advocate for criminal justice reform.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of Actual Innocence, a podcast to help bring awareness of wrongful convictions and the need for reform in our criminal justice system. Last weekend, I had the pleasure of visiting the Georgia Innocence Project and meeting with some of their staff and some of the people they've exonerated, and the experience was overwhelming. We talked largely about the needs that people have after they've been exonerated. That experience has made me think about and examine my show, and I want to tell you that there are amazing things in store for Actual Innocence. I'm going to let you know that there will be another episode next week, but then, in the following weeks, and through the rest of this calendar year, we're going to a bi-weekly schedule. I will be putting this in a calendar format on the website. I want to stress, we are not pod fading. Actual Innocence is here to stay and has amazing things in the works, including a three-part season finale that will be the last three episodes of this year. It's not something you're going to want to miss. Season 2 will start in January, and it's going to be a story like you've never heard before. I can't wait to tell it. But now, on to today's episode of Actual Innocence, after a word from one of our sponsors. Conviction is a new crime drama airing Mondays at 10, 9 Central on ABC. What makes this show different is that while most crime stories end behind bars, that's where Conviction begins. Each year, over 10,000 people in America are wrongly convicted. They could be victims of forensic errors, evidence tampering, and more. Inspired by real-life conviction integrity units across the country, the CIU's purpose is to review potentially wrongful verdicts, investigate, then recommend that the sentence be overturned or let stand. And they have just 5 days per case. The CIU team, made up of lawyers, a former detective, and forensic experts, is led by Hayes Morrison, an ex-president's daughter and reformed party girl, who now stands as a defender for the unjustly prosecuted. She's not afraid to raise a little hell, and is known not only for her feisty attitude, but also her willingness to question every part of the judicial system. In this week's Torn from the Headlines episode, when a wealthy suburban family invited a troubled youth into their home, their generosity was repaid with murder. But when the case comes into question, a whole new battles of the haves versus the have-nots is reignited. And the picture-perfect surface of this family portrait is shattered by a multitude of homicidal twists. It's a case that will have you guessing and second-guessing right up to the very last minute of the episode. From the executive producer of Criminal Minds, Conviction airs Mondays at 10, 9 Central after Dancing with the Stars on ABC. Anthony Graves was on death row and had 2 separate execution dates. He described the experience as pure hell, your worst nightmare. But my interview with Anthony was different than most, partly because it was video, and I can see in his eyes that this is a man who had been through hell, but was now using his experience to advocate for others and to live life as fully as he could. It was truly inspirational. I'm Brooke, and this is Anthony's story.
I always like to start way back at the very beginning. What was your life like before 1992?
I really don't like to talk about my life.
No?
Well, my life was, I was just a normal person. That's why I don't talk about it so much, because I wasn't a person that grew up in the poorest of the neighborhoods and had it bad. That's not my story. I was a normal person. I had three kids. I worked. I did everything that I thought was the right things to do. I never thought that someone would knock on my door, and I ended up sharing my story with you on the screen. So
you know why I think that's important though, because that tells my listeners that this isn't. That wrongful conviction isn't a problem for any type of person. It's not exclusive to someone who is poor or someone who's black or someone who's white or someone who lives in a certain part of the country. Anybody can be wrongfully convicted.
Except for if you're making $75,000 or more in this country.
That's true.
Yes, you can get good legal representation at that point. So you exempt from things that I went through if you're making $75,000 or more. So no, everyone is not susceptible to wrongful conviction. Those who are making $75,000 or less are more susceptible to those who are making $75,000 or more in this country. It's a money game.
So how old were you at that time?
I was 26.
And do you remember what you were doing on the day the crime that you were convicted of happened?
Well, I was wrongfully convicted of a crime in Burleson County, and during that time, I was at home with my family. I had alibi witnesses. My girlfriend was there and everything. But it wasn't enough to stop a young African-American man with no resources from going to death row.
And can you tell me anything about the crime? Like, did you know what the crime was? Had you heard of it?
No, the crime... as I said, occurred in the small town, Burleson County, which was like 35 miles away from my hometown. And six people were brutally murdered. They were shot, stabbed, plunged to death. Gasoline was poured on their bodies and the house was burned down. Right? And so that was an outrage because this was a small town where nothing like this had ever occurred. And they wanted justice. They wanted whoever had done the crime to be brought in. And so as a matter of fact, the mayor decided that whoever had done the crime, they didn't deserve a trial. They should be caught and hanged. And that's sort of the way they proceeded with the case. And lo and behold, a week later, there was a funeral. And a man showed up at the funeral with bandages. Turned out that this man was the father of one of the children that was murdered in the home. Well, he became a person of interest. So the Texas Ranger who was at the funeral saw him and they asked if they could talk to him. They followed him home. Picked him up and later take him to the DPS office where they interrogated him over 14 hours. Nobody knows what today, even what he had said, but at the end of it, he lied and called my name and said that I was involved in a crime with him. Well, he really didn't know me. He knew of my name because he had been married to a cousin of mine that I grew up with, who wasn't close at that particular time, but he knew me through my cousin, knew my name through my cousin sharing her family history. And so he called my name because he thought that he had just seen me in a Jeep coming off the freeway onto the feeder when they were taking him to the DPS office to interrogate him. So he thought one of the young black guys, it was four, he said, that was in the Jeep. He thought one of them was me. So when they pressured him to call a name of someone who could have done the crime with him, he called my name, not thinking that they would come and arrest me, but they would find out that I had nothing to do with it. They would let him go, but, you know, I would not have gotten arrested. But I mean, you know, and that's his naivete, because what we realize today is that's not how our system works. If you put somebody in the line of fire, they're pretty much going to get burnt if they have no resources. So when he put me in this line of fire by lying on me and said that I was involved in some crazy crime with him, that's all it took to take my freedom and possibly my life. The state moved with that theory, knowing that they had nothing to substantiate his claims, knew that they made him lie. But they had the information that said that I was innocent, because the same night when the guy found out that they lied to him about letting him go, he went recanted and started trying to tell the truth. Well, they didn't want to hear that. So the next day I was arrested and charged with capital murder. Nobody investigated. Nobody tried to find out if the story was true. They just arrested me, charged me with capital murder, and started trying to build a case on me. Why? Well, it's a small rural town in Texas. Okay, and that's why. And I was a young African-American man with no resources. That's why.
So what was your interaction with the police like? Like, what was the interrogation like?
I cooperated 110%, which is what they got up on the witness stand and attested to. that Mr. Grayson has cooperated with us 110%. As a matter of fact, even during the bond hearing, the lead investigator got up there and said, there's nothing that we have in this case that connects Mr. Grayson to it. Still yet, I was denied bond by a judge who was up for re-election. I mean, I was just stripped of 18 and a half years of my freedom because they didn't want to admit that they had made a big mistake. So I suffered some political consequences and I almost lost my life.
Episode, you hear me mention my newest sponsor, Framebridge. I mentioned that I was going to be using their company to get my degree framed. And I had ordered the mailer by visiting framebridge.com and using the discount code ACTUAL. I even made a Periscope about it on Twitter. Well, after my trip to Atlanta, I came home and the mailer was waiting for me. It was perfect. My degree was safely sealed inside, and it even came with pre-cut tape strips and a UPS label, so I didn't need any external supplies to seal up the box and send it back. And shipping was free both ways. I can't wait to update you about the finished product. It was so easy. I just went to framebridge.com and chose my frame. But they also have designers that'll help you pick one out if you need. You can even upload your photo from your computer or even directly from Instagram. How cool is that? And when you've made your selection, you get to preview your picture in the frame you've chose. And then you're done. You just order it. I've also discovered that they have an app, which makes it super simple to set the pictures that have been living in your phone forever free and allow them to decorate your walls. Or if you're like me and you want to frame a degree or a piece of original art, you just have to enter the dimensions and they take care of shipping both ways. And the frame process is the same. And the best part, it was so affordable. Instead of paying hundreds of dollars like at a framing store, their prices start at just $39. And did I mention that shipping is free? Plus, when you use my code ACTUAL, you get a 15% discount off your first order. I've had a couple of listeners who told me that when they go to the Framebridge site, a pop-up window comes up and asks for your email. You actually have to click decline discount on that window to be able to enter my code, which is how Framebridge knows that you're a supporter of the show, so that's really important. Remember, the code is ACTUAL. I loved all the different styles they had, and I'm sure you will too. There really is something for everyone. So you can get started today framing your photos or art or degree by going to framebridge.com and using my promo code ACTUAL to save 15% off your first order. Remember, just go to framebridge.com and use the promo code ACTUAL. And they also have a Twitter, at Framebridge. And so, since you had no resources, you had an appointed attorney?
Yes, I had a court-appointed attorney who was African-American, who had never really tried a capital case, but definitely believed in me. I watched this man cry when they convicted me, but he was just outmatched, outwitted, and basically had a seasoned prosecutor who was used to getting away with these type of things.
Was it a jury trial?
Well, anytime you have a capital case, it's a jury trial.
And did the jury look like you? Did they look like me? What was it, a diverse jury?
Like you. They were one white, one African-American. And he was the foreman of the jury. I remember when my attorney asked me, he said he was going to go back and find out who they want to pick for the form. And it was 11 whites and one black at the time. And I told him it was going to be the black guy. And he didn't understand why I was saying that. And then when he went back there, he come back and he asked me, hey, how did you know it was going to be the black guy? I said, because they finna convict me before they even hear the case. And they're going to put the black guy in the front as the face of the jury. That's why it was going to be the black guy. And it rang true. He was the foreman. They convicted me. And then he didn't realize that they took his rights to vote not guilty away from him because he couldn't be the only person on the jury voting not guilty. So by them making him the foreman, they actually controlled his vote. And he didn't even realize that. You know, he had to vote guilty if they was going to vote guilty, he had to vote guilty because he couldn't be the only one saying not guilty. It looked like it was a race thing then. So he was put in a position that he didn't really understand. I understood it, which is why I told my attorney it's going to be the black guy, because I grew up in a rural part of Texas and I understand racism. And I understand how they prep for it. So I knew that what they were finna do was convict me because I was a young black man in there that a white man saying that I did a crime I didn't do. And they were gonna put this black man in the front to make it to our best, I guess, give it credibility by saying that, hey, this black man was the foreman of the jury. So he was convinced that he was guilty. So that's what it was. But in actuality, the black man was just as, he was the powerless of all 12 on the jury.
Right. And do you remember how long they deliberated?
Yeah, hour and a half.
An hour and a half.
It took 9 hours for the guilt innocent, and then an hour and a half since the death.
And so what happened next?
Well, what happened next is I spent 18 and a half years living in hell trying to prove my innocence. I was sentenced to death. I had 2 execution dates. I witnessed over almost 400 men around me being murdered, men that I got to know and love as family and friends. Seen them not as monsters, but as human beings. But the state said that they were not redeemable, and they were being murdered around me, sometimes twice a day. You know, things that's etched in my mind forever. It was living in a nightmare, and I did it for 6,640 days. 2 execution dates. I mean, you know, and now I'm here.
And I know this sounds like a very naive question, but what is death row like? Like when you wake up in the morning, what happens?
You think hell is like? That's what death row is like, 365 days a year. Whatever you think your worst hell is, that's death row. I mean, so when you think about your worst nightmare or your worst hell, then you're talking about the life that I live 24/7 for 365 days a year. 18 and a half years. I can't just say death row is defined as one thing or another other than whatever you think hell is, that's death row.
Is it isolation? I mean, you got to know these men, but...
Yeah, we lived in solitary confinement. All of us. It's just designed that way. So I lived in solitary confinement 16 years of the 18 and a half that I was incarcerated for something I didn't know anything about. I listened to men just lose their minds, slitting their throat, cutting their wrist, overdosing on their medication, all because they couldn't take the conditions of solitary confinement.
And you had two dates, like, that you were supposed to be executed. And what stopped your executions?
Well, number one, they were premature. I hadn't even gone through the appeal process yet. So what was happening was that the DA was relying on my attorneys to be inexperienced so that they can set an execution date. He doesn't file the proper papers. They execute me and nobody asks the question. But luckily for me, because I hadn't exhausted my appeals and I had a competent appeal attorney at the time, we were able to get a stay of execution based on the fact that I hadn't even exhausted my appeals.
And so you are here and you are talking to me today. So what led to that? What were the steps that led to your exoneration, to your freedom?
Wow. Well, many steps. You know, I went through a lot of attorneys that came on, believed in my innocence, but because the wheel of justice takes a long time to turn, for one reason or another, they were getting off my case. So I met this lady named Nicole Kosovitz. Nicole Kosovitz was a journalism teacher at St. Thomas University, and she had a class that she was teaching about wrongful convictions. She went into a seminar for Texas Innocent Network, who was being ran by a guy named David Dow. David Dow was holding a class on wrongful convictions. Nicole and her students showed up at their class, and it so happened that day they were talking about my case because a freelance journalist had gotten in touch with them and said, hey, y'all should look into this case. So David was talking about my case that day and was telling that it was a short fuse, we did a lot of investigation, and wanted to know who would be willing to investigate the case just to find out what was going on in the case. And Nicole and her students looked at each other and they raised their hands to say that they just wanted to look into the case. And they didn't go into the case thinking that I was innocent or guilty. They just wanted to look into the case. Got to looking into the case, and what they found was unbelievable. And so they ended up staying with me for 8 years, overturning every rock that my innocence. And in 2010, I was exonerated by a special prosecutor who had already put 19 men on death row. So she was no bleeding heart liberal. But she said this was so bad, so egregious, that the prosecutor had did everything he could to withhold the facts of my actual innocence, that it was basically criminal. And so she moved to have my case dismissed and have me exonerated because she believed in my absolute innocence. And ended up here today because after what I witnessed and what I had gone through and seen the people who had fought the fight for me to regain my freedom, I decided that that was a torch that needed to be carried by me to fight for other people's freedom that I knew were back there that was wrongfully convicted, that had mental illness issues that needed therapy or needed counseling other than incarceration. So I picked up the mantle and I have been out advocating for a better criminal justice system ever since.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions based on what you just said. The first one is, I'm a social worker and I work with people who've suffered from severe traumas. Were you able to access mental health care after you left? Because like you said, you had been in hell for many years. Like, were those resources available to you?
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is, I think the resources were available to me. I just didn't know about them. That's a big problem with guys reentering society. That there may be resources available, but they don't know about them because they're not promoted, they're not highlighted on television or anything like that. Really, it's like a needle in the haystack. You really have to find them. So because of that, I started the Anthony Graves Foundation. I become a hub for those resources so people can call me and I can connect them to the resources that are available for them out here. But yeah, when it comes to the mental illness, I share a story with you. I decided that I was going to go and try to get some counseling, you know, just talk to somebody about my experience. And I met with this counselor and we talked for maybe 30, 40 minutes. But she was so distraught. She was so shook up about my story that I ended up feeling like she owed me money because she used up all the tissue, you know. So I knew then that it wasn't going to work for me one-on-one. The best thing for me was to be to take it to a stage and let everybody hear my story. That was been my story. So now what I do, I publicly speak about my story in front of crowds of people, and that sort of gives me my life back, and it helps me get through what I've gone through. So people don't understand when they come to hear me speak that I'm using them to help get my life back. But it's a win-win situation.
And that was my second thing that I was going to ask you about. You have become an advocate for people who have been wrongly convicted. And I was just wondering, you know, what kind of groups do you speak to?
I speak all over the world. I speak to criminal justice reform groups. I speak to district attorneys around the country and their offices. I speak to defense attorneys. I speak to prosecutors. I speak to judges across the country. I speak to law enforcement across this country, law schools, churches. I have been all over the place. I've spoken in the oldest church in Rome, in Switzerland, and Sweden, and Paris, and all the states. I did a congressional hearing here at the Senate with Senator Dick Durbin on solitary confinement. It's a historical event, and it had never been done. I speak at the Congressional Black Caucuses on issues involving criminal justice reform. I work with legislature and local senators about reforming our system. So I use my story to put it in front of those who have influences to make change.
And I noticed that on your shirt, other people can't see it because this is a podcast and they're listening, but is it anthonybelieves.com? Is that if somebody wanted to get a hold of you to hire you for a speaking engagement, is that how would they do that?
Yeah, if they want to get in touch with me, they go to anthonybelieves.org. And you can just, you know, there's a questionnaire on there and everything. Ask you what, you know, if you want to book me and what would the subject be, et cetera, et cetera. You can get me on my website.
And so I have a couple more questions. And these questions aren't ones that I always ask, but you have such an inspirational after story. I was just in Atlanta last weekend, and I was talking to some exonerees that are kind of down on their luck. Like they have told me that that it's better to have committed the crime and be paroled or be put on probation than to have been exonerated because there's more programs. Do you think that that's true all over, or do you think that that's a Georgia thing?
Definitely, because we haven't embraced the fact around the country that we're actually sentencing innocent men to prison. So it's like an anomaly. It's like we don't have programs designed for those men, because we don't think that we are sentencing innocent men, okay? So why create programs for innocent men returning back to society if we're not sentencing innocent men? All right, so all the programs are for those who have done, that have done the crime, served the time, and now trying to return back to society. Those programs are set up for those guys. They're not set up for someone that you wrongfully convicted, and now you have to help make an adjustment back into society, because they don't have there's different rules to that game. Number one, you owe this man. You owe them for punitive damages, all the things you've done to him and his family. Over here, this man served his time. Over here, this man paid his debt to society. So now you got programs to help him come back home. But you have no program for the man that you messed over, because you refuse to believe that that's what you're actually doing. Right? So yeah, I think it happens all over the country, because nobody wants to wrap their head around the fact that we are actually convicting innocent people, and we'll actually execute innocent men. We don't want to wrap our head around that, because that means that we now have to make change. And change is hard to come by in a system that sort of, kind of preys itself on its victims. You know? So I think that in order to get a better system, the mindset has to change first and foremost. We have to want to seek justice for everyone. Not those that look like us, but for everyone. And when we can wrap our heads around the fact that it's supposed to be a system for all of us and not just some of us, then we can get to some of the hard questions and find some solutions for them. But until then, we have this, how can I say, it's like a gap that's missing. It's like something missing in terms of everybody wants to think that when someone is wrongfully convicted, it's an isolated incident, although numbers and statistics show that it's not isolated. But we want to trust our system so much that we think that our eyes are lying to us when it comes to the numbers and things, because that gives us our false sense of security. How dare you take that from us by telling us that our system doesn't work? So you have to get through all of that first before you can actually get to the reform. You have to reform the minds of the people and how they see and feel about their criminal justice system. Our criminal justice system has become criminal, and we're responsible for that, because we are refusing to acknowledge that we have big problems in our system. And it starts with the fact that there's a disconnect between the different races of people out here. So when you have 95% of your elected DAs across your country are white, and then you're looking at your numbers, your statistics of why so many African-Americans who only make up 13% of the American population, 46% and 48% incarceration, had 46% percent of the incarceration rate, it goes back to there's a disconnect between this white district attorney and this black defendant. And because there's a disconnect and the prosecutor, this white DA has the power, and he can play off his fears. This man gets sentenced to life. Well, if this young white man came in, he gets help. And it's not about so much that is, up to a certain point is racism, but it's also the fact that I don't know you, and I've been taught to fear you. Okay, so because I've been taught to fear you, when you come in and my counterpart who looks like me say that you've done something, I'm more inclined to believe my counterpart, because I've been poisoned by all this rhetoric since I've been a kid that you are a bad person, that your race are bad people. So 95% of our elected DAs get that challenge every day of how do I deal with this young black man who I have no connection to? We have a civil rights problem in our country, and that is that there's not enough diversity in our district attorney's office across the country. And that's leading to a lot of wrongful convictions. And that's something people are not addressing, because we want to think that's because it's written on paper that we can follow the rules. I'm sorry, that's just not the way it goes. All right. And so, yeah. So knowing these things is why I felt it was so important for me to get out here and carry this mountain.
I think that's great. And I think that it's great that you're not afraid to say that, that you're not afraid to identify the problem and give it a name.
Well, I you know, maybe 20 years ago, I've been afraid. But after you have sentenced me to death, given me 2 execution dates and murdered a lot of people around me, you cannot threaten me with that. You can't threaten me with hell, as what I always say, you know, because everybody that you killed never came back and complained. So you cannot threaten me with hell. I'm going to speak the truth, and I live with it or I die with it, but you can't threaten me with hell.
So what advice might you have for someone who finds themselves in a position of being wrongfully accused or wrongfully convicted? What would you tell that person?
I would say fight, fight, and fight some more. Every day that you get up and write a letter, just ask someone to help save your life, is a day closer to your freedom. Every day you get up and miss an opportunity to write a letter, to ask someone to help save your life, is a day for the state. Okay? So you have to choose, who are you going to fight for, the state or for yourself? That means that you have to get up and you have to communicate with the world and let the world know about the injustice that you incur. Not only that, but you got to keep a positive mind. You got to know that you're going to stand on the truth whether you live or die. And you got to be and you can't be afraid of which one happens first. You have to stand on truth. And if you stand firmly on truth, you'll get through anything. Whether you come out of there walking or you come out in a cardboard box, you can live and die with yourself knowing that you stood on truth. So I'll say to any man that's innocent behind those bars, stand on truth and be willing to suffer the consequences, because then and only then can we really, really make change in our criminal justice system.
And so I get this question, like I've gotten over 100 letters of people asking me, what can they do to help? People who are not attorneys, people who just listen to the stories on my show. What can they do to help people who have been wrongfully convicted?
Number one, I would say the first thing you should do is reach out to him and let him know he has unconditional support, that you don't know him, but that you support him just because. That's the first thing, so that he can feel like he's not in this fight alone. Next thing after that, there's a local legislative body. There's council members, there's senators, there's state representatives that you can write to and voice your concern about a certain case. You can do that. You can go to hearings, legislative hearings. You can sign up to speak on bills. You can do a lot of things because you are a citizen of this state, and then it's all of our system. Do not feel that you don't have a voice in it. It is your system. You do have a voice. You can go up there and be heard. You can speak in front of your legislative body. You can write to your congressman. You can go and set up an appointment for him and talk to him and voice your concerns about this case. You know, there are so many things that you can do. But the first thing you have to do is reach out to the one you want to help and just let him know that you're there. And I promise your roadmap will unfold right before your eyes as to how you want to help an innocent man save his life.
Is there anything else you want to say that I didn't talk about?
Well, I just want to say that, you know, through my experience and all the things that I've done out here, I've been the first to use a law that has disbarred the prosecutor that wrongfully convicted me. I did that last year. And to me, that gave me some closure. But more importantly, I've written a book about it that's going to be coming out around the first couple of months of next year. It's going to be called Infinite Hope. Infinite Hope, How the State Failed to Kill My Soul. And it's going to be coming out in the next couple of months. I would say to anyone, get it and read it. It's very educational and inspirational because it also talks about holding on to the things that you believe in that can get you through what you're going through. It's what I did. You know, I remember the time when they had indicted me of the crime, and I had been reading the Bible because I was innocent. And I came the next day, they had indicted me and they brought me the papers. And I never forget, I had just been reading the Bible. And so when I got these indictment papers, I was so upset, I took the Bible and I just threw it up against the wall because I didn't want to believe nothing that it was saying to me, because here it was, I was innocent. And all they told me I had to do was go to God and pray and that everything would be all right. But yet, here I'm getting indictment papers, and I've been praying and I've been reading this Bible every day. Why am I getting indictment papers? They told me just go to God with this. So I was really upset with God, and I took my Bible and I threw it away. I threw it aside the wall. I didn't want to have nothing to do with it. Later on that night, my soul was disturbed. I couldn't get no sleep or nothing. It was like 2 or 3 in the morning. And so something just said, go pick up your Bible. I've been frustrated all day. For some reason, I went and picked that Bible up, and I can't remember the exact word, but I mean the exact page, but I remember the passage, and it told me that God put nothing on me that I can't bear. And when I read that, it seemed like it just renewed all my strength and hope and fight for justice. And I never looked back. And my faith just continued to grow. Through my adversity, my faith continued to grow, and I never looked back. And today I'm writing about this, how you can overcome with faith.
I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. I want to say a special thank you to the Georgia Innocence Project for hosting our meeting last weekend. And thank you to everyone who attended the meetup, and especially Larry, who probably saved my life. Next week will be an interview with an exoneree, and then after that will be every other week episodes while I prepare for the amazing season finale and continue to work on season 2, which will be something like you've never heard before. You'll be able to see a schedule of the episodes to come by visiting our website at www.actualinpod.com. Now, here's Stephanie with the credits and a reminder on how to stay in touch.
This episode of Actual Innocence was hosted and produced by Brooke Giddings. The Actual Innocence volunteer team is Stephanie Satilli, Sarah Nelson, Megan Delaney, with production assistance from Matt Ryan. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Twitter at ActualInPod, that's Actual, I-N-P-O-D, or email us at ActualInnocencePod@gmail.com. A special thanks to our sponsor, ABC and Framebridge. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice.